You are watching The Next Step, and my name is Dave Wass. My guest today is Robert Bernstein. The name of the program is Robert Bernstein Speaks Out. That's right. On this program, this series of programs, we want people who are not afraid to speak out and not don't have to go along with the big crowd. This guy is a loner. I know he's a loner because I'm a loner. Okay? Two loners. Are we alone? I guess we are. Okay? He's also a nanotechnology design engineer, whatever that is. And he's also very active in the Sierra Club board. He's going to be talking about the overview of challenges overlooked and ways to address them and how to think strategically. Now, if you're really confused by all that, so am I, okay? There's one thing that he did say in our pre-conversation that will start this series of exchanges. He told me, gave me a term, said there are things called 90% issues. And so let's start with that. Robert Bernstein, what is a 90% issue?
Okay, well, let me back up a bit, and let's just talk about strategic thinking in general.
Okay.
I started doing activism back in the 70s and 80s, and what we would do is, you know, we would organize rallies and marches, and we'd bring speakers, and we'd do cultural events, and do direct aid projects, and you do those things because those are the things that people have done before, and that's what activists do, and... But in the back of my mind, I was always thinking, yeah, but what is the strategy? And in fact, there was a guy who used to come to our meetings who used to say, you better have a strategy or you're not going to ever achieve anything. And and my answer always was, I don't have a strategy. I'm just doing this until I can figure out a good strategy. But
that's an honest statement.
It was an honest statement. But on the other hand, I was always looking for strategies, and a lot of the activism that we were doing back then, well, in the 80s, Reagan was murdering people in Central America, and so...
You were involved in commenting on that.
We had a group called the Central America Response Network, and we had these really dedicated volunteers, and I was one of them, And so, as I say, we put on an enormous number of events in the 80s, and you know, we would bring like ex-CIA people to come speak about all these atrocities and things that were going on behind the scenes and so on. And it was very educational, but the question was, what are we going to do to end this? And so I started looking at, you know, what are the underlying forces that drive what's going on?
What's the big picture?
Right. And so one of the things is, well, what are the economic forces behind this? And so you look at the militarism and you say, what drives the militarism? And what drives the militarism in part is, you know, you can say, well, there's these big corporations that profit from the militarism. But on the other hand, you have thousands of rank and file workers who also profit from the militarism. It's their job. And so I came across this guy, Seymour Melman, who was an industrial engineer at Columbia University, and he had written a book about the permanent war economy, and he had written about the concept of economic conversion and how we could do a lot to end the militarist culture if we could convert our economy from making bombs to making things that people actually need. But the problem with that is that we already are making all the stuff that we need. In fact, in a way, we're actually overproducing what we need. And so that was how I got interested.
In those days, we were.
Well, I'm saying the world is. We don't make much of anything anymore. I've always been in the world of manufacturing, so I make stuff, but most people don't in the U.S. anymore. So then I started looking at another way of looking at things, which was just the whole vicious cycle of overwork and overconsumption. And I got involved with the Shorter Work Time group, and And we have this website, swt.org, for the Shorter Work Time Group. So my strategic thinking, you know, was, well, okay, so we want to have economic conversion, and in order to have real economic conversion, we need to stop the vicious cycle of overwork and overconsumption. And
so you asked yourself questions.
I asked myself questions.
In arriving at strategic conceptions and answers.
Exactly, and so then the question is, what's the biggest obstacle to this vicious cycle of overwork and overconsumption? You say to people, oh, are they just sort of greedy and they're always just trying to acquire things? Is that why they're so overworked and overconsuming? Mm-hmm. But actually, it's not true. In fact, the real problem is that American workers have very little control over their work time. For example, if you decide that you want to work fewer hours, you may actually be able to negotiate that with your employer. Most employers won't negotiate that. They'll say, sorry, you work full time or you're out of here. But some employers may be willing to negotiate that.
Well, apparently you have worked that out with your
employer. Except that it turns out that if you do that, the health insurance company will tell the employer, sorry, you can't cover him.
Because he doesn't work, quote,
because he doesn't work full time. Yeah. And in fact, that's one definition of a fascist economy, is when a small number of corporations can dictate to other companies how they can run their business and how society will be conducted in general. And so I realized that one of the biggest strategic obstacles to shorter work time is the need for universal health care. And so back in 1994, I got involved with the group Healthcare for All, mm-hmm. and we had a proposition 186 that would have...
So you went from wanting to cut down your hours at work...
Well, it wasn't me personally.
But this group you were in.
No. This is me. Oh, this is my thinking. These are the issues that I got involved with.
Okay.
And so when we talk about these 90% issues, mm-hmm. what I realize is that if you can solve a certain problem, then you're 90% of the way there towards solving all the other problems that you're trying to solve. I mean, started out with, how can we stop bombing people in other countries? And now we've made a transition to talking about shorter work time, and then we've made a transition to talking about universal health care. And so the idea is, if you can solve the health care problem, you're 90% of the way towards solving the overwork and overconsumption problem.
So if you, it's like there's, you take that next step, it starts a whole train of changes.
Exactly. In fact, somebody should do a program called The Next Step. That would be a great
idea. Yes, that's a good idea. Yeah. Okay. We'll do that.
We'll do that. So another vicious cycle about overwork and overconsumption mm-hmm. is things that are just out of our control, things that we're forced to pay for and subsidize that we have no control over. And one of those is the transportation system in this country, the transportation and land use dynamic. If you Google America's autos on welfare, you will get a Sierra Club page which documents hundreds of billions of dollars a year of subsidies for private motor vehicle use, which amounts to thousands of dollars a year. For every...
This is, who's doing the subsidy? Are big companies paying their workers money to drive to work?
Or? Well, the subsidies show up in many forms. Some of it is tax dollars that go to pay for infrastructure. Mm-hmm. Some of it is the fact that when you go to the store and you buy something, you're paying for those acres of parking lot in front of the store, even if you walk there.
That's part of the price.
That's part of the price that you pay.
Transportation, yeah.
Exactly. And so in civilized countries, you know, you pay the true cost for driving. You In civilized countries, gasoline now costs $8 to $10 a gallon.
Now you say civilized, you use that term. Will you just fill it in a little bit?
Well, I mean, the definition of a civilized country is a country where basic needs are assured. This came up in the debate last week, where the moderator asked McCain and Obama, "Is healthcare a right, a responsibility, or a privilege?" And it was gratifying that Mr. Obama did say that healthcare is a right. Mm-hmm. And in fact, if you look at the constitutions of most other countries, the constitutions of most other countries include healthcare as a right. We don't have anything like that in our constitution. So yes, I think that is the mark of civilization, and certainly access to daily needs is a mark of civilization.
Mm-hmm.
And
access to daily needs. Yeah,
access
that's
to
an
daily
needs.
Right, and 1/3 of Americans cannot drive. Okay, so in a system of forced automobile dependency,
mm-hmm.
1/3 of the population basically just doesn't count.
Mm-hmm.
So this is another strategic 90% issue. Mm-hmm. Is if we can end forced automobile dependency, that also takes care of a lot of the vicious cycle of overwork and overconsumption. By some estimates, 40% of our economy has to do with forced automobile dependency.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, if you look at healthcare is another major part of our economy. In fact, those two are probably the two major parts of the economy. In fact, more so even directly than militarism. Hard to believe.
And healthcare, by many, is considered an option.
Yes, well.
And people can buy it with their own money.
Yeah, those people have never actually had to go out and try to buy it and discover that in fact, you can't. You can't buy actual coverage. And go see the movie Sicko and just remind yourself that everything that you see in the movie Sicko, all those horrors happen to people. Every one of them has health insurance. So we've got some problems. I want to, because we have a limited amount of time, I want to actually, in addition to talking about these strategic 90% issues, I want to talk about one major challenge that we face, mm-hmm. as activists that has been largely overlooked. And I don't know if this is going to show up here, but anyway, this book here is called The Big Sort.
And The Big Sort.
The Big Sort.
Okay, and who wrote that?
It's written by Bill Bishop.
Bill Bishop, okay.
Anyway, this is a new book out, and starting after the 2000 election,
this is a solution.
Well, this is a challenge. This is a challenge. So let me talk about the Big Sort as a challenge.
Okay.
So around the time of the 2000 election, we started hearing a lot about red states and blue states.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, this is not really true about red states and blue states. In fact, what we have is urban versus non-urban. And in the book, he has a map, which again, this will not show up very well. But anyway, this is not going to show up. But anyway, you can find these maps online. And these are county by county maps rather than state by state maps in 1976 and in 2004. And with the map, that's kind of nice. And what the map shows is the white areas show the parts of the counties that have competitive elections, and the two different shades are either all Democratic or all Republican. And what you see is that in 1976, a huge part of the country is white, meaning that the counties are competitive. Whereas in 2004, what we see is most counties are non-competitive Republican. The gray is Republican.
Wow.
And the dark, the black, is non-competitive Democrat. And you can see that...
That's for 2004?
2004. So what's happened is...
That shows looks like a total support.
Well, hold it. Okay, this is number of counties. Thing. So let me finish here. Okay. So this is this is by county. It's not by population. Mm-hmm. Okay. So so what you see is that if you zoom in there on the 2004 map, what you'll see is that in the urban areas like San Francisco and over there in New York and any of these places. Anyway, those areas are solidly Democratic. So the sort, the big sort, is actually not by state, it's not by the part of the country, it's actually by urban versus non-urban.
That's the big divide.
Okay. And in fact, if you look at the elections in the cities around the country in the 2004 election, it turns out that any city that can reasonably be called a city, I think the cutoff is 100,000 mm-hmm. population, 100% of the cities in the U.S. voted for John Kerry. And you have to let that sink in, because mm-hmm. that includes Houston and Dallas and Montgomery, Alabama, and Tallahassee, Florida. I mean, all these places that you think of as being in the middle of red state Republican territory, every one of those cities, 100%, voted for John Kerry.
Mm-hmm. So that's the big divide then.
That's the big
divide.
Between
an urban culture and a...
Non-urban.
It's non-urban. Okay.
And if you look at where the power is in mm-hmm. the country, in terms of who elected W. Bush, It's those people in the non-urban areas who go to those mega churches. The biggest selling books in the United States are the Left Behind series.
Yes.
The series of books about the post-Armageddon world, or how mm-hmm. it is that the Armageddon is going to happen in our lifetime. Almost half of Americans believe that Armageddon is going mm-hmm. to happen in our lifetime. That makes it a little hard to have
and
much...
And the big intellectual magazines do not write about that.
Yeah, well, that's a problem. Anyway, it makes it very hard to plan for the environment or even to plan for an economy to balance the budget or anything if you mm-hmm. believe that Armageddon is coming in our lifetime. And as you just said, Dave, it's not just that the intellectual magazines don't cover this. I mean, if you watch the network news, you don't know this. Mm-hmm. I mean, we talk about the corporate media being biased against our progressive ideals, but in fact, the corporate media isn't covering the Armageddon people either.
It isn't. That's right.
That's right. So we're missing this big divide, and in the past, we were able to do great things in this country because there were certain shared values. You know, everybody went home at night and they watched, Walter Cronkite on television. Now everybody lives in their sorted out community where their friends and their neighbors and their radio stations are all telling them what they already believe. And now with the internet, people can just get news that's filtered just to affirm their views. I was just on a road trip out to Wyoming, and you can turn on the radio and you can travel for hundreds of miles at a time, and you'll hear two Fox News stations and nothing else.
And that's it.
And that's it. And that's So this is a challenge that we face because a lot of the time we feel like, oh, all we need to do is sort of get rid of the corporate control of the media and develop our alternative news sources and just educate people and make people understand what's going on. But the problem is a lot of these people have a very different understanding and they have very different values. If they believe the biblical Armageddon is coming in our lifetime, they're not going to be educated about global climate change because they think we're stupid for wasting our time on that when, in fact, we should be preparing for saving souls for when Armageddon comes.
So, do you have a... I hate to bring up that word.
A solution.
Do you have a solution for the seeming disparity or tremendous difference between the urban and the non-urban cultures? Should we work against that divide, or should it be that be changed even?
Well, those are all the questions that we should be asking. Should we be working against it, and if so, how? And unfortunately, this book does not offer any compelling solutions. In the end, he has a chapter called "We Marry Our Enemies," and he talks about how past empires...
We marry our enemies.
And he talks about how past empires have thrived when the culture encouraged people of different tribes within the empire to intermarry. I'm not sure that that's necessarily going to be the most effective solution, but it's certainly worth considering. But I think that there is another kind of an education that works as part of it, and also one of the 90% issues I talked about in terms of transportation. The whole non-urban culture is entirely dependent on subsidized private motor vehicle use. And these people have this delusion that they are the independent ones, that they're the ones who are not dependent on government, and... You know, I drive my car, I don't use public transportation, I'm not using all that subsidized city stuff, and in fact, they're the ones that are most subsidized of all. In fact, if you look at this election, you know, Sarah Palin is, you know, the libertarian and all this anti-government rhetoric, and of course, as most people know, who bother to look, of course, Alaska receives the most per capita government subsidy of any state in the union, absolutely.
Really? And she parades around with this extreme libertarian attitude that...
Absolutely. In fact, if you want to know...
Do it for yourself. Don't let the government do it for you.
In fact, if you want to know, who is it that receives the lowest subsidies of anybody in the entire country? Do you know who that is?
Who is that?
The residents of New York City.
The residents of New York City.
They are the least subsidized people in the entire country. In fact, they... pay far more to the government than they receive back. So they actually get a negative subsidy.
So they're paying for the urban folks are paying for this non-urban folks' subsidization.
Subsidization, absolutely. Yeah. And so, you know...
You're upsetting a lot of apple carts here, you realize.
Well...
You're making it awful messy.
We're making things messy, but that's sort of what you have to do if you're going to make an omelet. You know, you got to break some eggs. So anyway, if you're going to solve the big sort problem, one thing you have to do is sort of shatter some of these illusions that these people have, that these libertarians, you know, are living some total free existence, free of government, when in fact they are generally the most subsidized of all. I remember when my brother was in college.
That's absolutely marvelous, isn't it?
It is. He was a geology student, and he had to do field work out in Montana and Wyoming, and he'd be driving these government vehicles that were full of bullet holes from people shooting at them because they hate the government. And it's like, of course, the big joke was that none of their jobs would have existed if it weren't for these government subsidies. Government subsidies. I mean, all of their mining wouldn't happen at all if it weren't for the government.
What happened to these people, though, if you taught them and showed them their absolute dependence on being subsidized by the federal government?
Well, that's the experiment I'd like to do, is to see how they would respond. And I have a feeling that their perspective would, in fact, change if they saw that. Now, the other big piece of the education, in addition to recognizing these government subsidies for their non-urban lifestyle, is the whole Armageddon thinking and their religious views, because in a way, you could say, well, that's resistant to education, because faith, by definition, stands outside of reason. It stands outside of evidence.
Right.
And yet, they seem to like to use evidence one way to their advantage. Right now, there is a movie in the theaters that's just come out this week. It's called Religious with Bill Maher.
Bill Maher, yeah.
Bill Maher. And It is totally blasphemous.
Have you seen it?
I have seen it.
Have you seen it? Where is it playing?
It's playing right now at Paseo Nuevo. I don't know if it's still
Do you recommend day. That our viewers take
I
a look at that?
I highly recommend that our viewers take a look at it. Because it indicates the sorts of things that do and don't work when challenging these people who mm-hmm. have these fundamentalist beliefs and these Armageddon beliefs. And the one that I thought turned out to be most compelling mm-hmm. from what I saw was being shown that the Jesus myth had been written many times before, going back about 1,000 years. And he gives these examples of Horus and then Mithra. You know, you have a deity who was born on December 25th, and there's a virgin mother and walked on water and all this kind of thing. And these people, their jaws drop. It's like, wait a minute, how could that be?
So all of these religious figures repeat are the same paradigm that's been started long ago but keeps on being repeated to
right.
willing believers.
Exactly, but it certainly waters down the fundamentalists, because the fundamentalists want to believe that there's something very fundamentally special about their religion and that they have to do exactly that thing.
Yeah.
Right. Anyway, we're
taking
very...
taking religion away from us now.
Taking religion away. So speaking of religion, there's one more thing in the very limited time we have left. And
two minutes. You got 2 minutes.
Got 2 minutes. Okay, is the New Deal okay? Is in many ways what we're trying to promote, the idea that government can be a force for good, that paying
who's we
progressives.
Progressive.
The idea that there are public interests that we're all working for together, and that there are basic services that are a right mm-hmm. and not a privilege. However, there was one part of the New Deal that was kind of destructive, and that was the whole creating jobs religion. And that comes back to this overconsumption and overwork vicious cycle. And here is another book, which
hey,
is...
Hold that up okay. nice and bright it's and the, high.
The,
so
The Politics of Simple Living by Charles Siegel.
Uh-huh.
And this one may be a little harder to find, but you can Google that and you can find online. And I actually...
The Politics of Simple Living.
I've ordered a case of these, so if you contact me...
Is that something like Thoreau? Is this guy... I mean, this doesn't look like a Thoreau-inspired
No. This is all about these 90% issues and strategies. This is...
That has the language.
This has... No, well, a lot of it, the strategies.
Right.
It's
now,
brilliant.
Now, before you go any further,
yeah, well,
I've got to thank you very much, because you slipped into our minds, in all our innocence, a lot of different ideas, and made us open to new strategies and ideas. So I wasn't sure about you. I saw you this morning, and the way you started thinking and talking, that you slipped through and gave us some new ideas and new inspiration and new things to try out. And I want to thank you very much, and I want to thank our crew, Juanita and Charles and Alex.